Skipper celebrates. Every show is a celebration. Richard Skipper celebrates the best in entertainment. Each show, Richard delivers the artists you love, showcasing what makes them unique, never gossipy. The antidote to a sometimes hectic world. Now, here's your host, Richard Skipper.
Happy Tuesday, everyone. And welcome to a very special edition of Richard Skipper Celebrates. Why is it special? Because my dear friend Michael Mackesy is joining me this afternoon. I've been so excited to have Michael here since the moment he said yes to me. I've known Michael almost as long as I've been in New York, and that's been quite a long time. We're going to talk about that in a few moments. For those of you who are here for the first time, welcome. My show is all about celebrating. It's about celebrating life, celebrating art, celebrating artists, celebrating whatever we can find to celebrate. And we have a lot to celebrate if we just take the time to do so, especially in these dark times that we're living through. There's a lot going on, but we need to take the time to celebrate. Michael's one of those people who do celebrate. If you were here for the first time, I hope that if you do enjoy the show today, that you will subscribe to Richard Skipper Celebrates. Leave a comment after the show below the show that you're watching here. Hit the like button and tell your friends about Richard Skipper Celebrates. I like to celebrate artists and their body of worth. Before I bring Michael on, I want to give those of you who do not know anything about Michael and who doesn't know anything about Michael, a little bit about what he does and what he's all about. Take a look.
I thought I would be the biggest thing in Brazil. You better be careful what you wish for.
He turned to me on his deathbed and he said, "Maxima, revenge and Muslim have been jinn to the Gantin Gantin, pigeon breathing hacking."
What does that mean?
Who knows? I don't speak Yiddish. "That's it, baby, when you got it, flaunt it! Flaunt it!" "What did Washington say to his troops as they crossed the Delaware? I'm sure you're well aware. Is this time repaid?
Time for open mic, and tonight when I give it a whack, then YouTube will wake up and see Facebook too. Open mic is me. Do you hear that? Live people! Cut into my time. This is my opening number. You are coming to me live. I am coming to you live from the Fontaine Ballroom here in Miami Beach at the Fontainebleau Hotel. I only have 50 to 100 of my... You may applaud. I love it when they do what you tell them. But baby, if you know what I mean, because I love being here with you. Dance break! Don't you dare. Don't you. Oh, no, actually, we are in the Fontaine Ballroom. Dance for Grandma. Dance for Grandma.
I love him. I love him. I love him. And where he goes, I'll follow. I'll follow. I'll follow.
I will follow him. Follow him wherever he may go. just followed him. Ever since he touched my hand, I knew.
I can't believe I'm seeing you during the daytime because you're a vampire.
I know. I know I am. It's very strange. And I'm looking and I'm going, okay, what time is it? Has the coffee kicked? Yeah. How are you?
I am so glad you're here. I want to show everyone one of my favorite pictures.
And did you freeze?
Is one of your favorite pictures as well.
Oh, I love that picture of us.
No, I didn't freeze. Do I seem frozen to you?
No, it did. It did a minute ago. But you know what? We're just moving on. Keep moving. We're good.
Keep moving. Moving on. Welcome to the 60s, whatever that means for anyone. But you and I, we have been around for a long, long time.
Since dinosaurs roamed the earth.
Since the dinosaurs roamed the earth. But you know what I can say? You and I both have earned the right to sing "I'm Still Here."
Oh, yes. In fact, you just gave me a good idea for next week. Anyway, I mean, we really have, because, you know, I teach, I coach, and I, you know, work with the children, the young kid, and people, you know, how do you know them? How do you know this? And I said, listen, we all started in the piano bar, you know, we'll talk about later, but like names, because, you know, we between Don't Tell Mama and the Duplex, and when we were all starting out, and some of them have moved on to, you know, household names, and they're amazed at, like, how do you know this person and that person? I'm like, we used to drink in the piano bars till 4 o'clock in the morning in, you know, a long time ago.
Billy Porter, Jennifer Lewis, all of these people who have gone on to these incredible careers. But, you know, it was a time. I mean, it's amazing, because when I think about all of us hitting New York, I've had Mark Allen sitting here, and we've talked about all of us hitting New York at a very specific time. I don't know what it was. Maybe there was something in the drinking water, which we will get to in a moment. But I want to go back. I've got this photograph here. I always like to go back to the five-year-old self. And this is a photograph of you and your sister.
My sister, Shelly, who's now a grandmother. Now,
are you a twin? Are you the same age?
No, I am 2 years older than her.
But you look the same age there.
She won't appreciate that, because she's like, I'm younger, but I do. I'll shave those 2 years right off. It's okay. It's good.
So I asked for a picture of you at 5 years old. So you are 5 years old in this picture approximately. Is that right?
I think so.
Because to me, that five-year-old self is that time before you start school and peer pressure starts getting added on, and you start becoming what other people want you to become, what other teachers want you to become, or what they think you should not be. Take us back to the five-year-old Michael Mackesy. You lived in Chicago. Am I correct? Am I frozen again?
Now, on my end, you froze for a second, so I didn't hear, but it might just be the connection.
It might be the connection.
All right, so ask me that question one more time.
No, growing up, you grew up in Chicago?
In the suburbs of Chicago, Wheaton, Illinois.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about the five-year-old little Michael growing up in Chicago and your home life, and then starting into school.
I had a great childhood. I had great parents. We lived, like in the suburbs, which back then meant fields and lots of space. And, I grew up, my mom's family, raised and showed horses. So we had a huge horse stable in the back fields and stuff. And I loved playing. I was always clowning around, because I go back and look at photos and I'm like, okay, even then I'm mugging for the camera. My mom she decorated for every holiday, which I have now inherited, much to my dismay and my storage unit's dismay. But no matter what holiday came up, you know, she was making costumes for me right before I went to school. But I have photos of us when I'm like 3, 4, and 5. Now, my dad was a big high school jock. And
somehow she got him to wear a kangaroo outfit. We were all in little kangaroo outfits, and then we were bunnies for Easter. And that poor man put those clothes on and posed for pictures with his wife and, you know, me. And then, you know, as I added, Shelley came along 2 years later and Patrick came along, you know, 2 years after that. So I just remember always having a great time. And I tried to figure out, because my mom wasn't really in show business or theatrical, I don't think, in any way. Because I kept thinking, where did this come from? You know, she played piano a little bit, but not much. But she encouraged me to. So I just, you know, took lessons. I'm getting ahead of myself. I'm the 5 year old, but I'm never really sure where all of this came from. I'd love to find somebody to blame. But, you know, right now I can only blame myself.
Well, you and I are both baby boomers. We both, doing my research on you, you also, very much like myself, grew up as a product of 1960s and 70s television. And yes. And like myself, you had these visions of what New York life was like. And that was always the ultimate goal for you. You had this ultimate goal of coming to New York and living to be, and I will let you fill in the blank.
Well, and I can't remember some interview I did where somebody had asked me some questions and I'd never really thought about it, but I would see I Love Lucy and I would watch Ricky go off to the club at night to rehearse with the band and perform at night. And I was like, I want to do that. I would see the movie Holiday Inn and want to be a big Broadway star, but then spend time on the farm doing shows only on the holidays. You know, it's Auntie Mame and all of, you know, all of the, you know, classic New York, anytime that it was something to do with Broadway in New York, I just always was like, I want to be there. I don't know how or why, but that's, it was like the bat signal that went out in Batman or whatever it is, the bat signal to go, okay, I have to go over there now, you know, but no clue how, you know, how or where that came from. I just was like, I have to do that. And then again, you're saying about TV and stuff. I was always watching, you know, like the Carol Burnett show. I grew up on that. I wanted to be Carol Burnett. Anytime there was anything, the variety shows, Ed Sullivan would have clips from like
The duck just came out of the ceiling because today is Ed Sullivan's birthday. So thank you for acknowledging him.
Well, and that's where a lot of that started. And then, you know, we just had the Tony Awards the other night and I would start to, I think the first, I'm such a freak. I collect them. I've got every Tony Awards that was on VHS is now digitized, but I have every Tony Awards since they were first televised in 1967. And the opening number was Joel Grey singing Wilkman from Cabaret. But I knew that they were there before that because I would learn about these things and I'd watch. And, you know, going back to my dad again, the high school and college jock and football, he was the captain of the football team, captain of the basketball team. He was in the farm team for the White Sox until he got injured. But it was like, Dad was the big jock. He'd walk through the room while I'm watching Ed Sullivan. He's like, what crap are you watching now? You know, that stuff, you know. But years later, when I had a house in Aspen and working at the Crystal Palace and everything was like good, he was certainly enjoying coming out for the holidays and hanging in Aspen with his son, the freak, who used to watch. So what are you watching that for? So that I can have this, Dad. Come on.
Exactly. You know, so absolutely.
It kind of came full circle. It's all right. I get it. You know. So, but yes, the 60s, 70s. Hi, Ralph Lampkin. Hi, Uncle Ralph. I just saw you pop on. Yes. Kelly Briggs. Kelly Briggs.
Yeah,
speaking of Old Home Week, you know, all that we're seeing names of, these are all people that were with us back in the times when we were talking about just a few minutes ago.
Right. So once these seeds get planted in your head, and we're going to talk later about, you know, one of the names that you just mentioned, you actually got to meet, which I am jealous about. But you, when once those seeds were planted, did you have the opportunity in school to start doing plays in school, or did you create opportunities for yourself before those opportunities were coming your way?
Well, again, there's parts where I kind of go, I don't know. I remember how excited I was in kindergarten to be one of the three kings in the nativity play. And my mom made the costume and I wouldn't take the cape off. I would walk everywhere with the costume. I was like, no, can't take this off me. During grade school, there wasn't really, I went to Catholic grade school. And then thank God my mom yanked me out of that. And I went to public seventh and eighth grade, which I remember in seventh grade, there was like a variety show. So I like played piano a little bit for that and also started doing shows. And I remember directing and starring in A Charlie Brown Christmas. It just, I would get the kids, you know, but I'm also that kid that, you know, we're out on the farm and I still harass my sister and one of her best friends that I used to round up the neighborhood kids and we'd put on circuses and wear costumes and I would put plays on in the yard and annoy the neighbors and make them all do things. So yeah, I was that person too. So that just sort of evolved.
My sister is watching. She's going to think you and I were separated at birth.
Well, she just may be, but it's like, but yeah, again, I don't know who to blame, but it just sort of, and I don't know where all this came from other than, I guess just by the time I'm watching TV and all of a sudden you see something, it's like with like people, you don't know why you're attracted to someone, but you are. And mm-hmm. sometimes there's no reason. You just go, I don't know why. I want this, or I like this person, or I like, you know, doing this. So yeah, that's where the freak started.
Now, I know that you lived in the suburbs of Chicago, but did you have the opportunities? I know that Chicago has a lot of opportunities now as far as performing arts are concerned, but were those opportunities available to you then?
Well, I ended up by the time, well, while I was still in high school, I applied to be an apprentice at the Pheasant Run Dinner Theater, which was not too far from my home, but it was one of those star stock. I worked with Bob Crane from Hogan's Heroes in Who Was That Lady I Saw You With? And I became great friends with the late, great Martha Ray. Martha Ray was doing Everybody Loves Opal. And Pheasant Run had a little like area called Bourbon Street, and they'd have a jazz club. And Martha Ray, we would go and hang out after. And I was only 16, and she would sing. And she was someone that on certain nights, because I was an apprentice, we had to do everything, clean the toilets, build the sets, reset stuff. And some nights we were there late and or almost all night. And I remember she found out one night that I was going to sleep, you know, on stage. And she insisted that I come back and stay in the guest room, you know, in her suite in the hotel. And we hung out and it was just, but those were opportunities that I just got started going, all right, I'm going to be, you know, a professional in the theater. I would see shows downtown in Chicago. Our theater teacher in high school, every Wednesday before Thanksgiving, he would take us downtown. So I saw my first national tour was Promises, Promises at the Schubert Theater in Chicago. And the following year was A Little Night Music with Gene Simmons and Hermione Gingold. Again, at the Schubert Theater in Chicago. Cut to 40 years later, I ended up conducting Avenue Q at the Schubert Theater in Chicago. And it was just like a full circle thing where I was like, this is where I saw my first whatever it was. So I was really lucky in that respect. But I got downtown Chicago and actually worked in Chicago like right after I went away. I went to Eastern Illinois University I graduated in 73 and went to Eastern, which we call EIEIU. And again, in the summer, I was an apprentice at the Little Theater on the Square in Sullivan, Illinois, which was another star summer stock, only they did musicals. Mm-hmm. And so the summer I was there, I ran follow spot for Rosemary Prinz, who was on As the World Turns, as Mama Rose in Gypsy. We did the very first regional production of Jesus Christ Superstar, which was picketed by the farmers at the cornfields because they thought it was blasphemous. And I ended up, and we just lost Peter Palmer, who was the original Little Abner. He would do shows there every summer. And I did The Sound of Music with him. And I also did My Fair Lady with George Chakiris from West Side Story.
Oh, wow.
By the time we got to those two shows, I wanted to be singing and dancing on stage. They found out I could play the piano, and I was immediately put into the pit. I could no longer be up on stage. So that kind of annoyed me, but I at least, you know, I think it paid $25 a week at the time. So I was like, oh, I'm going to make some money. But that all kind of came about. But again, was the working at professional theaters thinking, oh, I can do this. So after my sophomore year, I was offered a job in West Virginia. So I went there for 6 months and music directed. And then I went back to the Chicago area, started taking classes at the junior college and auditioning. And I ended up joining the cast of the brand new Marriott's Great America was opening just outside Chicago. And I ended up doing the company there, one of those shows, 6 shows a day, 6 days a week, singing and dancing, along with my friend Liz Calloway, who was 16 at the time, and Tommy Anderson. There's a whole bunch of us because we all ended up moving to New York about the same time. We were all Chicago people. Karen Mason, Anna Hammond Calloway, and Liz. And we all ended up moving to New York about the same time from Chicago. So I had spent some time in Chicago for a couple years. I did Godspell there. And then, like I said, we all ended up moving back to New York, not knowing what the hell we were doing. And then we all ended up working for Irvin Robb at the Duplex. Mm-hmm. That's when the Piano Bar and Cabaret stuff started and that whole network. So it just kind of eventually, you know, naturally evolved. I hadn't gotten too heavy into the Chicago theater scene before I left. But it was going very, very well. And it's still, to this day, there's still lots of theater going on there. So it's a great theater town.
Well, I want to dissect a little bit the move to New York and how that all came about. First of all, what specifically brought you to New York, besides obviously the career that you wanted to come to New York for? Did you have your equity card when you came to New York, or did you get the equity card after you got here?
No, I got my equity card for a theater, for a show called Carousel of Clowns. It was a big extravaganza at the Mill Run Theater, which was one of those in the round rotating stages where they'd have like Vicky Carr and Lola Falana, you know, the shows. Well, they did this huge singing and dancing, horrible, horrible musical, but there were just great people in it. So I got my card and, you know, felt like I was part of the Chicago theater scene. And, So I did that show, which was had my card, and then I think I also played. Oh yes, I played Geppetto in Pinocchio, all of like 20 years old with all the baby powder I could put in my hair and try to act like an old man. Which now I don't need any of that; I can just do it. But
well, welcome to my world.
Hey, it's the silver. It's the look. It's in. I'm just glad I still have some hair, so you know it's okay. But yeah, that's around that time. And I ended up directing, doing a little bit of everything for a show again back at Pheasant Run years later when it had gone non-equity and no longer had like the big names, but they were still trying to hang on. And I put together a show called Nightlife, and I had a few people in it. I don't know if you know my friend Cheryl Stern.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Okay, Cheryl was in it. I think I gave Cheryl her equity card in that. Two of my best friends, Bob Leonard and Brian Pollard, who are no longer with us. Debbie Leach. Remember Debbie Leach from Don't Tell Mama? Yeah. Yes, Debbie Leach was in that. And my friend who helped choreograph, Phil LaDuca, And he moved to New York, and he is Phil LaDuca of the LaDuca shoe that everybody, you know, I knew for years. I'm working with dancers and they're going, I got to get my LaDucas. And I go, oh, that's, and it took me 10 years till I put together that Phil, who had done a bunch of Broadway shows as well, started designing shoes for dancers. And now he's like the go-to, you know, every concerts, Britney, Cher, they all have LaDucas at shows. And he just had a baby. But I didn't know for years. Again, this is like going back when you and I are talking about how did you know Billy Porter and Jennifer Lewis and all the, we were just all around at the same time. And then all of a sudden you hear a name later and go, oh, I used to drink. LaDuca shoes. Now I get it. You know, it's the same thing. And I know we're jumping around a little bit, but, you know, Idina Menzel was my waitress at Don't Tell Mama on Wednesday nights for like a year. And we ended up doing a show that Lenny Watts put together in the back room called Starting Here, Starting Off, which was a review. It was a review of off-Broadway musicals because everybody was doing reviews of Broadway shows. And I remember giving her the song Sleepy Man from The Robber Bridegroom, which also Patti LuPone did. Well, she did the show, but then she also did it. I worked with her a little bit, and she did it in her show. But this was years before, and I had given it to Idina. And somehow somebody had a recording of that, and it's on like YouTube, and it has like 5 million hits. And it just be playing the piano and singing a little backup, but it's Idina singing Sleepy Man, which I love that song. Sorry, I'm going off in two.
No, it's okay. I'm following everything, and I'm right there with you. But I'm going to go back a moment to the equity card.
Wrote so me back.
At the time when you got your equity card, did you realize, I mean, for you personally, was getting the equity card a holy grail item for you in your career at that moment?
Oh, it was a huge deal because that's at the time, equity was a lot different than 99% of all professional shows were equity, and it was not easy to get. Mm-hmm. And back then, a lot of times, the easiest way to get your equity card was from a children's show. Hello, Carousel of Clowns and Pinocchio. But you still got it, and that just opened doors to where you finally were considered. Mm-hmm. This was years before, and I don't even know how it works. Well, of course, it doesn't work anymore now. Anybody can join if they got paid $1 for a show now. But back in the day, there were no such things as equity membership. You know, you worked, and eventually you were hired for a show that included that, you know, you got your equity card from that show. Type of thing. And then they started adding all sorts of different rules and there was this and all that. But at the time, that was like the biggest thing in my life because it was like that's what I had aspired to do and to have. And then I think that happened. It made it easier for me to move to New York.
So when you came to New York, you had your equity card. Was it easy for you as far as getting work at that time, or was it a hindrance for you?
It was easy to get auditions and get into the rooms, although even still back then, you know, equity chorus calls, you signed up at 5 a.m. and you stood outside, and there were only like 200 or 300 people now as opposed to 2,000 or 3,000 that are, you know, nowadays. But I also, you know, well, you saw that picture of me at 5. I looked like that until I was like 40. So, you know, there was not a lot of my type, shall we say, because I fell in between vocally. I wasn't a rock out tenor. I wasn't a big bass, so my voice fit right in the middle. I always used to joke that I had to be a star because I wasn't good enough to be in the chorus. I couldn't dance well enough and I couldn't sing high enough, so I had to be a star. You know? But
I know.
For all those years, and that's when I also started playing piano a little bit more. When I moved to New York, and we were just talking about this the other day because we also just lost Jane Powell. And it's weird how connections all of a sudden, you know, Jane Powell, big MGM star. When I moved to New York in 78 or 79, I think.
And you came to New York in 79 as well. I met you in 1982. That yes. was when I first became aware of you. But 79 was also the year that I moved to New York, and it was a very different New York.
Oh, yeah. 42nd Street. Mm-hmm. Hookers, Hustlers, Fresh from 8th Avenue. That's a song from Seesaw. Anyway, in Chicago, while I was working and doing Godspell, actually, the touring company of the original Pippin was in Chicago at the Schubert Theater for like 6 months. And I became friends with Michael Rupert, who was playing Pippin at the time. And he said, you know, he was like, listen, when you go to New York, you're going to go, we're going to hang out. There's a place called Great Aunt Fanny's. It's like home base. And so that's exactly what I did. I got to New York. I went to Great Aunt Fanny's, which was a restaurant on 46th Street on Restaurant Row. And I talked to Ron, the owner, and Wednesdays through Sundays, they had the fabulous Gladys Easter at the piano. This phenomenal black woman who played and sang, not very well in either case, but the whole, it's sort of like Mabel Mercer. Like, it's just like, it was the experience and the persona.
She owned the room.
Yeah, it was fascinating. And at this restaurant, Ron let me play, because it was one of those things where the restaurant would be slammed from 5:30 to 7:30 before theater. It would be empty from 8 to 10, and then the night shift would come in and everybody come over after the theater. So Gladys played from 9:30 on, and I played from 5 to 8, and for $10 and dinner, which back then was a huge deal. And so I started playing there, and I couldn't play and sing at the same time. And when I did, I could only do ballads. I couldn't play an up-tempo song and sing. I had to do one or the other. So that helped me over the year and a half, 2 years that I ended up working there. And like, I had Liz Calloway come over and do like her first cabaret show before she was doing her show at the Duplex. And like, I'd call in on friends. But at Mama's, we became friends with Sugar Babies, with Mickey Rooney and Ann Miller. They would have their cast parties there a lot. They'd come and hang out. Mm-hmm. The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas, that was like their homeroom. They all hung out there, so I got to know all these people. And it was like a whole new world. And Jane Powell was famous at Great Aunt Fanny's for their biggest and most popular dessert was Jane Powell's apple nut cake. Mm-hmm. And it was a huge deal. And Great Aunt Fanny's had postcards that you could mail, and on the front it had a little sketch of the building, and you turned it over and it was Jane's recipe for the apple nut cake. And people, those were big deals that people would keep. I still have mine. And so this, when we just lost her last week, and all of a sudden I was like, Jane Powell, Great Aunt Fanny's, I first moved to New York, all these people, this is sort of how, so, you know, and all of a sudden I went, I haven't talked about this or I hadn't thought about it. I ran into a few friends of mine online that were back from the day. My friend Suzanne, who was in Whorehouse, and she's like, oh my God, I just remember all of this. This was also, mind you, where I'm buried in the songbook and I'm in the corner at the piano and I'm not performing. I'm playing background music. And I have the songbook open. On the left side is an 8x10 of Jerry Herman. And on the right side is the music. And I'm playing, and I happened to look up, and at the table just up against the piano, there was that face smiling at me. And it was Jerry Herman.
Wow.
And I immediately froze, because I'd always been told that you should never play, if someone comes in, a star or a composer, don't play their songs. They don't like it. And I was like, so I immediately thought I was going to get creamed. And couldn't have been nicer. And the same thing happened a couple weeks later with Fred Ebb, because that was there, you know, like Joe Allen's now and some of the restaurants, people would go to specific places, you know, every week. And so that was a whole nother eye-opening thing. I'd just be playing there and I look up and go, oh, hi. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's what sort of got me started in New York. And while I'm still playing there, this cute couple, Irv Rabel and Rob Hoskins, would come in and have dinner because they were building Don't Tell Mama across the street. And they'd already owned the duplex mm-hmm. and Brandy's, and I knew of them. And I became friends with them, and they let me do my first cabaret show down at the duplex. Because back in those days, A, you had to audition to do a show at all.
That's right.
And B, you had to start, like, if you wanted to play when Mama's eventually opened, if you wanted to play the main room at Don't Tell Mama, you had to have done a show successfully at the duplex before they would let you move uptown. And then the same thing later on with 88s, you had mm-hmm. to have played Mama's, you know, those were the days. And now it's like, you know, you got 20 relatives from Jersey, you can play the room. How many people yeah. can you get in here? Which right. is sad, but, you know, hey, it is what it is. But Irv and Rob took me under their wing, and then I moved across the street. But and
interestingly enough, you need to tell them what your act was, because that might surprise some people.
Well, my act was actually standing up and singing, because yes. everybody knew me in New York from just from playing the piano, and someone else actually played for me. My friend Marcy Stein, who Marcy Stein used to, with Bob Amaral, used to run the piano bar at the Callback Lounge at the Beefsteak Charlie's on the corner of 45th and 8th. Mm-hmm. And that's where Bob Amaral would host. Marcy would play. He could play anything. And that's where I ended up, you know, hanging out and becoming friends with Nathan Lane. Before he had gotten onto Broadway, he was part of a comedy team called Stack and Lane. And they would get up and do, you know, Stiller and Mirror, it's a comedy, you know, and they were hysterical. Then Stack would go on to go other comedy clubs, and Nathan would hang out and sing show tunes. He wasn't really singing show tunes, but he'd hang out and drink with the rest of us. So again, it was that circle of, well, how do you know so-and-so? And how do you, we hung out. We just happen to be in the same place, and you meet the same people, and everybody just starts, you know, talking. So, but like Marcy played my first show, and I called it Just Another Victim of Pianist Envy. And because people were always like, I'm so jealous that you could play the piano. And I was like, well, I'm glad I could play the piano, but sometimes it doesn't let me get up and do other things that I started out doing, because once they found out I could play the piano, I could no longer act, sing, or dance. Now, luckily, that has since changed mm-hmm. a bit. But in a lot of times, I'm still known as, well, you're that piano player. And even on nights like at Don't Tell Mama, when I was working, I'd sing all night. And then somebody I knew, or Marcy or Michael Orlander, somebody would come in and they'd play a song for me. So I'd get up and stand up at the mic and sing. And actually, I used to do my favorite year there from my show, but I'd do it in the middle of Mama's on, you know, midnight on a, you know, Wednesday night. And I'd stood up and sing. And the room gets quiet, and then afterwards people come up and go, I didn't know you could sing. I've just been singing for 6 hours, like singing. But because the piano was in front of me, it wasn't, you know, tuning out or whatever. So that's when I stopped telling people I could play the piano. And it was a whole different thing. And then they started looking for actors who could play the piano for shows. And I went, oh, I play the piano. So, you know, times change, you know, people change, and you just kind of, you ride the wave, so to speak. But, mm-hmm. but anyway, but that's how the whole New York thing started, was from Michael Rupert in Chicago and Pippin, and then going to Great Aunt Fanny's, and then moving across the street to Don't Tell Mama. And I got to be one of three piano players in the front room the very first night Don't Tell Mama opened, and it was myself. Oh, hello. Are we back? Oh, yeah. There we are.
Yeah. For just a second. Good. Keep going.
Hey, it's working. It was myself. Well,
Mercury is in retrograde right now, so weird things are going on today.
Well, and I'm on Wi-Fi and not Ethernet, which I also know that sometimes that's a, it's yeah, better to be.
That's a no-no. Yes.
Yeah, to be plugged in. My Ethernet cable is at Brandy's. We'll talk about that later. It's a long term. But and Christopher Marlowe. So those are the three of us at the piano, you know, I was basically their break pianist. They were, you know, and we just kept it going. And then like a month later was when Karen Mason and Nancy Lamott shuffled and opened, you know, the cabaret room. But those early days at Mama's were just, well, you know, because you were there. It literally was a hangout. You could see people and hang out and meet people that became like lifelong friends and family, even if you only saw them at Don't Tell Mama. You'd never see them at a party or go to the movies or something. You just knew that, well, I'm going to go and hang out here. You could always go in alone and see, you know, 5-10 people that you knew and hang out. So you didn't have to worry about, well, I don't want to go out because I don't have anybody to go with. I'll, you know, feel weird.
I want to share a story with you, and then I want you to elaborate on this. A few years ago, our mutual friend Annie Hughes was in town, and we went out to dinner. And after dinner, we were having dinner at Joe Allen's. She said, I want to go to Don't Tell Mama. And I said, with all due respect to Don't Tell Mama, which is a wonderful establishment, and I love it, I said, it's not the same thing. It's not what it was when you were here. And she said, oh, it can't be that different. Let's go. So we go to Don't Tell Mama. And at that time, there was a red velvet robe. This is Annie. We walk in. She moves the red velvet robe. We walk in. The hostess comes running over and says, I'm sorry, but you can't do that. And of course, this is pre-COVID and everything. And Annie says, no, we're just going to hang out at the bar. She says, no, you can't do this. And he says, what do you mean you can't just hang out at the bar? And she says, you have to be seated. There was a two-drink minimum at the tables at that time. And I remember I used to live on 47th Street. On a Friday or a Saturday night, and sometime in the middle of the week, the place was packed. Everybody would be standing out onto the street. It was like a block party almost. Everybody knew everybody. Everybody would be singing. It was a huge party. Everybody supported everybody. It wasn't a competition. It wasn't anyone trying to out-sing each other. It was just this feeling of, as you just said, family. Can you talk a little bit about that from your own perspective and why you think it changed?
Well, I think it changed a lot because sort of Broadway changed in some ways. And, you know, like I said, Idina Menzel was my waitress on Wednesday nights. And we're working in a club called Don't Tell Mama, which is a show tune from a Broadway musical. Mm-hmm. And yet Mama's eventually went to, I filled in a couple of times a few years ago. And I remember playing, and my stuff was Broadway show tunes. And people were like, oh my God, I love Broadway show tunes. You're playing a show tune. And the staff would get up to sing, and they'd be like, you want to hear a pop tune or a show tune? And I'm like, don't ask them, sing some. But they were so conditioned to the louder and the screamier you got, because people could still come into Mama's and talk and have a good time, but they weren't screaming over the performance. They were aware when people got up to sing, you know.
Okay, hopefully he's going to be back. Sorry, this happens. Like I said, Mercury is in retrograde right now. And for those of you who put any credence in this, I hopefully he's going to log back on before we hopefully lose him. He is on a Wi-Fi, which is not really conducive to doing StreamYard. Hopefully it'll be back. Mercury is now in Libra, which is all about balance, balancing everything out. But he's absolutely right. It was a feeling at one point of everybody really being there and supporting each other. And it seems to me like a lot of the piano bar scene is very different. That's not to knock what's there now, because there's an audience for that. People still love that, go there. But we're talking about a time where everybody was there. It was a great place to go and try out material. It was a great place to go and see what would be working. You know, everything that I learned as an entertainer, I learned from going to the piano bars. Just getting up, singing. Karen Miller, Rochelle, here he is. He's back. We're going to bring him back on.
I hate it. And I'm looking, I'm going, I need a 12-year-old because I'm like, what button? Of course, this is the other thing, which we never got to with this whole world of live streaming and all this stuff we've been doing now for a couple of years, when how we learned things we never thought we'd ever need to know.
That's but right. I, absolutely. It's, but anyway, we were talking about, you know, the genre has changed.
And I was saying this, but in the old days, like at Mama's, people had respect for the fact of what it was. That didn't mean it wasn't a concert. You didn't have to stop. You could literally sit at tables and talk and carry on and still not be screaming over the poor person. And those kids then and now are working 6 and 7 hours schlepping to all these sometimes not nice people that are just crammed in there screaming and demanding. And then they get up and sing their guts out and have to scream over the crowd and then try to get up for an audition the next morning to try to, you know, get out of there. It just used to have more respect. And it just, you know, but again, it's like, well, like the cabaret rooms, we all used to have to audition to get in there. You knew that when you went to the Duplex or 88s or Don't Tell Mama or the Five, you knew that the talent, whether you had heard of them before or not, was good. It's not that way anymore. And that's no slam to anybody that wants to do cabaret. More power to them. But you wouldn't just walk in and go, I've never heard of this person, unless they've got a catchy title or the picture, you know, someone's pretty or handsome, and you go, oh, I want to see that guy sing. So that had changed as well.
But I will tell you another thing also, that they would come out, and this was when Don't Tell Mama had the one big room in the back. They would come out and say, Lena Katrakis, Karen Mason, Nancy Lamott, Jennifer Lewis, Billy Porter are going to be doing a show in 30 minutes. If you want to see the show, let your waitron, as what they called it in those days,
waitron,
know about it. And your drink, if you're drinking, will go towards your 2-drink minimum. And they would encourage you to go from the piano bar into the cabaret room to see a show. And now the piano bar has become a competition to the piano bar, to the cabaret room.
It's just hard to get in. But and also, to that end, sometimes those singers would get up and do a song.
Yes.
You know, and work, let the room go, and go, come on, I'm in the back. And but anyway, then at some point,
and before you go on, I also want to say one other thing.
Yeah.
Nobody worked a crowd like Jennifer Lewis to get an audience to come see her.
Still to this day. But it got to the point, again, like I say, like, you know, now the cabaret shows and stuff. And I can't fault the clubs too much, because they've got rent to pay and they've got to stay open. And if they were getting, you know, more people, it's like they don't care what the type of people that come in. They want to cram in all those seats and get those 2 drinks that prices keep going up and up, you know, to get $5.50 for a soda. But that's not just like Mama's. That's most of these places. And you know, to make that money. And so that's how all of that just started to change. And it became less about the people that come in. You know, so it would just, you know,
Kelly Briggs has a comment that I want to touch upon. He says, you would go to all the piano bars to advertise your act. And that's absolutely the truth.
Exactly. You would take your cards, your flyers, you'd go into each piano bar, you'd get up and do a number, and you'd hand out your cards. And that would happen. Yeah, that was exactly, you know, what would happen. And so anyway, there were still clubs that were trying to hang on to, we're a, you know, listening room. Cut to like 2.5 years ago. A guy I knew approached me because he wanted to open a piano bar and he wanted me to sort of do it with him and to come up with things. Long story short, we ended up naming it was in Jersey City, ended up naming it Pianist Envy. They had my old poster on, and we were going to have, you know, little logos and stuff. It started off as a great idea, but the guy who booked me, my friend, was also in with two partners, and we had singing waiters. It was going to be like the old days. Within a month and a half, it got to where they started letting anybody in to like be loud and scream. And it was like, and we tried to do numbers, or I'd try to encourage people when I'd introduce, and I'd say, now this is so-and-so, and you know, we got a couple of numbers here. This is live music. You can go anywhere that doesn't have piano, but it's like, we love that you've come. I tried to mention it nicely without being a complete bitch, although sometimes I do, mm-hmm. but it would be like, we love that you're here. We're here to entertain you. And you know, because we know you could go anywhere else, but you chose here for the live entertainment. So thank you. And you try to think that they would get, after a while, a month later, they fired me because I was trying to tell people to be quiet in a piano bar that was a, and so I was like, you brought me in to do this. And it was one of the things that I said before we even started. This can't just be a catch-all in a screamy room. It's going to be like performing. You hired singing bartenders and waiters and me. So why? And, you know, and it just went right in the toilet. And at first I was like humiliated that I was fired from my own club. And then I'm like, okay, wait, I can't. I said what I wanted to do. You said you wanted it. You don't want it anymore. Okay, we're fine. So that was just unfortunate. But it's the way that a lot of these places have gone. And again, it's a double-edged sword. I get it from the club's perspective, but at the same time, why do you open a piano bar or a music venue and give not two shits about the actual entertainment? Then don't put entertainment. You got a jukebox. Cram people in and get them drunk. But if you are going to put music in, respect it. It's just as simple as that. And no, not every night's going to be, completely quiet and attentive. But we've all grown up knowing how to deal with crowds, and you joke about it. And, you know, everybody since the dawn of time, people have dealt with hecklers and people, you know, it's just part of the gig. But when you're going to do this now, because Kelly's here, I want to just bring up the fact that last year during the pandemic, I went to my friend Lynn's. We've been friends for 35 years since I used to work in Atlantic City.
Lynn, who we love.
Lynn Heiligman, she's best friends with Lenny Babish. Introduced me to her. Lenny was Pudgy's music director. Well, I knew Pudgy from.
Can I say something? This Friday night is mine and my husband's 10th wedding anniversary.
Oh, congratulations.
And Lenny Babish played our wedding. And also, Pudgy and I headlined together in Atlantic City.
That's another, you know, full circle, and things come back. Well, I went in March when everything shut down, because I had been doing Piano Bar Live at Brandy's, which was great. And you joined me when we first started at the Duplex. We were there for a month, and it was Scott Barbarino's idea. And he just said, well, we're going to do this show, and we're going to film it live on Facebook, and you just do your thing. And I'm like, we're what? Mm-hmm. What is this Facebook Live? Anyway, cut to, we had been doing that. I went down to Atlantic City for what I thought was 2 or 3 weeks to hang with her at the beach and just go, well, I'll just go down and stay. 9 months later, I finally left Atlantic City area to come back to New York. But I had started doing my current show, Open Mac Live, which is just me, you know, weekly live streaming. And I had started it down there. Then I came here and did it in my bedroom. And now I'm doing it back at Brandy's every Monday night at 7. I've got to get that plug in. Monday nights at 7, live on Facebook. But we love a live audience. There's no cover. Just be vaccinated and come on in. Back to Kelly and his husband, Keith. They run the Gateway Playhouse, which 30 years ago, it was the South Jersey Regional Theater, and I was the music director for the Sound of Music. And now all of my Von Trapp children are grandparents. and I use that line, and I say it every time I'm there. Keith and Kelly, during the pandemic, so this was last August, September, they started, we did an outdoor piano bar. They went outside the stage door. They put up twinkle lights. It was phenomenal.
That's
social
great.
Distanced. The mics were all taken care of. I'm watching time to you. Sorry, I'm going to the mic, everything. It was monthly, and to get a live audience, and the people were clamoring. They're like, "Okay, we're outside. We're safe. Everybody's spaced. It's outdoors. We're singing. It's having a great time." Because of that, we moved indoors back in April. So I now go down there once a month, and I do piano bar in the theater. And the people come, incredible people, and they get up and sing. Keith and Kelly started this to help keep the theater viable and getting it going. And so we're doing this every month. And it's just little things like that that slowly got us back, you know, into the swing of things. So I had to say, I had to do that shout out to Keith and Kelly, because they literally are the first ones like, okay, let's try to do this live. And, you know, you almost started crying when you heard people laughing and applauding, because it
great.
Was that big a deal. And it's still like that. So
is all the information on your website for this?
It is.
Okay.
It is.
So I will have
and I'm always, there. Yeah. And I'm always posting on Facebook there. Who and what and where, and you know, where we're at. You're welcome, Kelly.
Great. So we are going to run out of time, but before we run out of time, this is my little homage to James Lipton and the Actors Studio. So I've got a list of questions that I want to ask you that are just some random questions that I'm going to throw at you. And the first question is, what is the biggest, and I put this in quotation marks, mistake that you've ever made in your career that you think was a mistake, and how did you get past that?
I guess I would. I think it would come into my dealing with agents and or managers, because I've never really had one, because I was never really kind of pushy, and mm-hmm. you would get in the door, and I would think that if somebody expressed interest, I wouldn't follow up as much. I'd think, oh well, they want to manage me, they want to be my agent, so they'll let me know when things come up. That never happened. And I always kept thinking, had I been a little pushier, where would I have been? Even now, I'm still trying to get an agent. If there's any agents out there to go.
Well, if anyone's watching, you know.
It's just one of those things, because it's even harder now. And now that people have been out of work for, you know, 1,000 years, they've got clients that need to work too. So, but that, I think that's been my biggest mistake, was that I kind of assumed that it would come to me and not be a little pushier. But I also knew pushy people that I thought, I don't want to be that name and have people roll their eyes when they hear that name. So, you know, but I guess that's the biggest mistake, I guess.
Yeah. Well, get pushy. Start getting pushy.
I'm old now. It doesn't matter. I ain't got the most time left. So it's like, it's now or never, people.
What is the quality that you most love in other people?
Openness and a good heart. And you can tell, you just, when you talk to someone, whether it's someone you've known or someone you're just meeting, you know, when you just sort of get a feeling about someone and go, oh, okay, I don't know you, but I like you, you know, it's just that feeling. And again, the feeling we used to have of walking into mamas and the family and people that you'd not normally talk to, but you're like, oh, I like you guys. Okay, I love you guys. I remember the group that Karen and Rochelle used to cultivate, starting the Duplex, and then at 88, we used to joke that it's 11:15, they're doing Little Shop of Horrors.
It's 11:15.
Yes. And I still talk to some of those boys, because we've had a couple of 88's reunions over the years, people that used to be regulars, and it's just – that was still, but again, part of the family and people that you only knew from there, that when those places were gone, you went, oh my God, I don't know how to get a hold of so-and-so or whatever happened to, you know, but anyway, sorry, I keep yakking. No,
that's great. What is the biggest advantage that you feel that you have in your career right now?
The fact that I could play the piano.
Very good.
It used to be a hindrance, but a lot of that came because I can do a show myself. I don't have to, like, I play for quite a few people's acts, and, you know, they hire me hourly in the show. And a lot of people can't always afford to do a show. You know, like, I couldn't afford to do a show somewhere because I couldn't afford the piano player and then the flyers. And the, so at least this way, the self-promotion, it's like, I love to stand up and do a show. In fact, I'm going to try to do one someday. But I can just go into a space and, like, what Keith and Kelly give me at the, I can basically do my show and have guests. It's the same thing when I do, you know, Open Mac Live. And I also, on Monday nights after Open Mac Live, I go down to Pangea, which is on 2nd Avenue and 12th Street, a great restaurant and cabaret. And I host open mic there on Monday nights from 8:30 on. And it's a great place to come and just hang out, get up and sing if you want to. No pressure. It's not, you know, Liza's not coming in. It's not like a, some of the rooms, and again, more power to them, but some of these rooms are so stressful that you don't want to get up and sing. This is just, it's like my living room. And so that's the biggest
thing. The food is great too. The food is great there. So,
oh, yeah.
What is the single best thing that you feel that you've ever done for your career? And maybe you just answered that. You know, you, I mean, the piano is, you know, one aspect of it. But what is one single thing that you feel that you've done for your career that really elevated you?
Well, it was finding people that, you know, I used to I music directed for like 15 years because I wasn't right type. Once I got older, grayer, and fatter, I was able to get back on stage. And my friend Steve Steiner, who ran Surflight and who used to be my bass player for my act, he's somebody that believed, yes, you can music direct and play the piano, but you can also be in a show and be on stage. He gave me my first Edna in Hairspray. So I start and I got back on stage and through Edna and then other friends that I'd worked with, then I got Max and the producers. And so I've done numerous productions of both of those shows now. And I still can go back and forth because then I also conducted the national tour of Avenue Q and Titanic and Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. So I just want to work. And I love doing, people go, which one do you prefer? I don't. I love both at the same time, but I don't want to stop doing either. So, you know, that helped a lot, but I love being able to get back on stage.
So as you've said in other interviews, a dress or a fedora, and you can go on the road.
Oh, Edna's in the closet right now. She's in 6 boxes. Right. I'm ready to go. We're packed.
What is the most difficult thing about being in this profession now? COVID excluded, of course.
That there's so many people now and so few opportunities, because especially for like Equity, like in the old days, 95% of the national tours that went out were Equity. Mm-hmm. And now, thanks to Equity, which I'm not a huge fan of in the last few years, but, you know, everybody does what they can. But they've given more and more concessions that it's almost better to not have your Equity card so that you could keep working. Because a lot of the tours now, and the Avenue Q tour that I went out with was non-Equity for the actors, but it had the entire Broadway sets, costumes, production team. It was the and the quality was phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And this is also not slamming non-Equity productions. Most of them are, you know, first rate. But it's the bottom line that our union has let people come in and just, where's the work for us? Because it's dried up. And so, and there's more people looking for it. So it's just, it's very difficult to try to continue in the business now. And especially since this last thing of like, anybody can get their Equity card and they have to buy it, but you can have it. And that's not going to matter. Talent's still going to will out. One could only hope, but it gets you into the room, but that now makes, instead of the 1,000 people that are online outside, there's now 3,000 people online outside to get into an, you know, to auditions and stuff. And it's just, there's no great answer for that. It's just, this is a difficult business, no matter what, no matter when. But I, you know, like you, I wouldn't do anything else.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
what's the strongest part of your career?
Still being here.
What do you boast about most when you want to impress people about your career?
I think my hairsprays and producers, but then also like my cabaret work and I won a Mac Award at the very beginning, but when Max first started, for a male singer, and then 40 years later, I won for Show of the Year when we did Piano Bar Live. So it's been 40 years between Mac Awards, but you know, they were there. And I love my cabaret work stuff too, so I'm proud of that. So again, I try not to be too pushy, although I will send stuff out on Facebook all the time going, look at this. Self-promotion.
And my last question to you, what would you least be able to forgive in your career?
Disrespectful people, whether to you directly or witnessing it.
Wow.
There's no reason to be, you know, to disrespect or be a hateful human being. There's just no reason, because there's too many great people that are not a-holes and are more talented than somebody else who is one, you know, but anyway.
Well, I said earlier, and I mean this, I'm not just saying this, this is not lip service. I love you. You're always worth celebrating. I'm thrilled that you said yes to doing this today. Don't go anywhere for a moment. I want to thank everybody for being here. You could have been anywhere else for the last hour, but you chose to spend it with us. And those of us who are in this business, I can speak only for myself. I think I can speak for Michael when I say this. I don't take it for granted that you could have been anywhere else for the last hour. So thank you for being here. Again, if you did enjoy today's show and this is your first time, please consider subscribing to Richard Skipper Celebrates. As I said, I'm all about celebrating. I'm celebrating artists and their body of worth. There are over 300 artists that I've celebrated over the past year and a half. Go and check out those artists. They all have stories to tell, and I hope that you'll listen to their stories. And check out the stories of the artists that are coming down the pike. Listen to the stories and pay attention. Go and see them if you can. If they're doing anything virtually, check them out. And with this show, hit the like button if you did indeed like today's show. Leave a comment after the show and share this with your friends. Leave a comment on social media and tag both Michael and myself. You don't mind if they tag you, do you, Michael?
No, I love being tagged.
Same here. And I also end every show by telling everyone to go out and do something nice for somebody else without expecting anything return. After today's show, go to your Facebook friends list, and the first name that pops up, reach out with a phone call. Not an email message, not a text message, not a private message, a phone call, and let that person know what they mean to you. As my dear friend David Friedman says, we're all in this together, but we're not in the same boat. And you never know what someone else is going through right now. But I always say, if you're going to be out in a boat, make sure you bring a skipper along. Now, Michael, I'm going to leave the screen.
That was good.
And I'm going to give you the final word. Anything that you want to say about anything that we talked about today that you want to build upon, anything that we didn't talk about that you wish we had, or just any message that you want to put out to anyone who's watching right now, it's your platform. Thank you again. And
thank you. I was honored to be asked. Listen, I just love the fact that there are still so many of us from the old days, and we still get to reminisce. And I'm looking at like Ralph and Kelly and like seeing people, and that we can still get together and remember the incredible times we had, but we're still having them now. And again, just for like a little plug to plug myself, but every Monday night I'm live on Facebook and YouTube at 7 o'clock, live streaming from Brandy's Piano Bar, again, one of our old haunts. And please, if you're in Manhattan, come to Brandy's Piano Bar live and sit. And also then later in the evening, we're down at Pangea and I host open mic. So it's opportunities to get up and sing all over town. Please just support cabaret and theater in general, because it's coming back. And thank you for tuning in. And thank you, Richard Skipper, for inviting me to this. I've loved it and I love you. And I'll see you very soon.